everyone, and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present, and future of all things business and esports. It's been absolutely mad over the last few weeks in the run-up to Christmas. We've had some amazing guests, and the feedback that we had from my stint on the Esports Observer podcast was greatly appreciated. To return the favour, we've brought the man himself, Graham Ashton, onto the show. He is the lead editor for the Esports Observer and host of their podcast, and I believe that he joined them about halfway through this year. So, been absolutely loving all the content that they've been putting out. And yeah, let's jump right into the show. Graham, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me, and thanks for that introduction.
My pleasure. So before we get stuck into your story, the Esports Observer has always been a media source that's always been quite close to my heart. When I first started working in the space, kind of built up a lot of initial, not I wouldn't say prestige, but reputation by writing a few recruitment pieces, either when I was at my last job or when I started looking for group. So I'm always going to be indebted to Chris Hanna for letting us do that. How did you find your way to The Observer? Take us through your story.
Sure. So during this year, the Esports Observer started hosting semi-regular networking events. They were called Esports Exchange, and it's something we're going to be introducing back in a big way next year. I mean, that's all I can say for now, but events are going to play a huge part in what we're doing. But they had one at The Factory, which is a co-working space here in Berlin, which is where we're based. And it's a pretty intimidating co-working space. I believe SoundCloud and Pinterest and all the sort of, you know, branches of Silicon Valley are all hanging out there. And so I went at the time because I thought, like, I've been writing for esports for some time, like, for a few different websites, for myself. And, you know, I think a lot of people say, like, oh, I accidentally wound up at the esports. But I was definitely like, no, I really want to get in this space somehow. So I saw they were doing a networking event. I believe, if I recall correctly, the talk was quite an interesting title. It was Esports, you know, Fad or the Future of Sports. And they had a really good panel there. And so I went and enjoyed the talk. And then during the customary networking session, I spoke to someone who – I didn't speak directly with Chris, but I spoke to someone who knew him, and he organized kind of like a lunch. And after a few meetings, he was at the time looking for someone to take over editing duties, you know, to start helping to shape content for the year ahead. And that's really how I wound up into it, just really like fell right into the role. And for me it was great because it's not – I mean, whilst I definitely wanted to work in esports, I hadn't really envisioned taking – you know, writing for an esports business publication because there's so few of them, right?
Sure.
But I always found the writing of business stories so much more interesting. I used to do more game coverage. And I mean, if that's your thing, then I mean, you know, it's a great industry to be involved with. But for me, I mean, I didn't really like so much the game recollection. I mean, interviewing players is great, and I still love doing that when I have a chance to. But what I loved was the kind of the business angles. So for example, I was writing for a Hearthstone section, which is it's still an unstable esport in many ways. And teams have come and gone a lot there, and there was almost like a spate at one point of just several, you know, big esports organizations just dropping their Hearthstone rosters. And I find that was very interesting because once you get over the phenomenon of people playing games for a living, well, then you have the phenomenon that they can no longer do that because, you know, you think like, how does someone get to play games for a living? Well, actually, how does someone get to play games for a living? It's a very difficult business, you know, on a very rocky foundation. And, you know, whilst we have very stable scenes developing now, you know, that wasn't always the case, you know, long before even I got involved. And so I just found covering that aspect very interesting to see how the industry was trying to reshape itself and build a better foundation. And to now be in the crux of these, you know, huge initiatives from Riot and Blizzard this year, you know, the franchise leagues and even stuff like the Dota 2 competitive circuit. I mean, it's, I don't know if this has always been the case, but I feel like right now we're in the most exciting time in esports. But I don't know, maybe people 5 years ago said the same thing.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. I think we are in one of the golden ages of esports. I think that with franchising being involved with this year's tournaments just being always bigger and better, that it's put a lot of pressure on everyone else to really up their game. And with the likes of PUBG coming in as well, you know, I think that there is a lot of pressure on everyone involved, especially from the events piece, to keep elevating the scene. We've also seen so many of these sponsors and non-indirect brands that we've mentioned on the show repeatedly step in and kind of just add that extra level of gravitas and seriousness to the space.
I was just going to chime in. I mean, the sponsors, but even more so the investments, which is you know, something like for us at the Esports Observer, we're always like kind of rubbing our hands waiting for the next investment story. But the investment story is like, on the outside, you know, the mainstream press and I think a few other publications, you know, we all love to point this out, like, hey, this company, you know, this huge big name venture capitalist or sports team has invested in X person, and it's really big, and we should all be really happy. And I think in the most part that's the case. But of course, the thing about the investments is you get to also take that chance to be critical. Yeah. And I think for a long time, I mean, we had almost some what of a weird reputation at one point of being overtly negative towards the Overwatch League, which I don't know if maybe I can't speak for everyone in the publication, but I think our opinions range from really excited, which is me, to some of us are a bit more cautious. And I think it's because we were, like everyone, a bit, you know, skeptical of these like 20 million franchise slots and all the huge investment that had to be done in order to make the teams viable. But of course, I do listen to the people who are very skeptical of that, because if for somehow the league fails or it just doesn't meet its targets, you know, that's a lot of money burned. It's a lot of experienced investors who've unfortunately made the wrong call, and it can have long lasting impacts. So it's really important to know, you know, not only the rate of investment, but who's investing into what, and ultimately what, like, it's hard to always analyze the goal or the end point, but I from my perspective, I think, like, there's some huge investments that seem smart and sound, and there are other ones where you're like, well, we'll have to put a pin in that and see where it is, where it goes.
Yeah, it's been pretty interesting from my side. I've undergone a pretty strong 180 degree switch on my opinion with the Overwatch League and the amount of money that's been thrown in there. As I've kind of understood the VC model in a little bit more detail, you know, just because, say, the Overwatch League does fail and that would actually blow up in everyone's face, the entire business model of a venture capitalist is to risk, and, you know, one out of eight shots hits and then you end up making a lot of money. So I don't support the opinion that I used to have, which is if these investors get burned, they're never going to come back, or there won't be others to replace them. So that's an interesting point, because now I'm still not sold on whether Overwatch is actually a fun title to watch, but the narratives that are being put together, the kind of structures that are being put around teams in local markets, are making me really excited about what they can do for maybe more struggling markets. I mean, I was lucky to have lunch with Red Eye earlier today. Yeah, it was awesome. And obviously, Code Red Esports just released that they have partnered with Cloud9 to run all of their esports operations in London. And hearing about, I mean, this is all in your article, I think.
Yeah.
But just hearing about all of the amateur, semi-pro, and the talent flows that they're going to be building in the UK market for amateur leagues, for semi-pros, for UK talent into their contender team, and just everything that they're going to be able to kind of build around the Cloud9 brand being based out of London, I think it's really exciting, and I know that the mayor's office are pretty keen to get them involved.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So that's
because I think there are a lot of raised eyebrows with London Spitfire. You know, it's difficult for me to relate, because whilst I kind of grew up next to London, I haven't lived in the country for a few years. But you know, I think the problem was, I think that you have a company that is not, or a team owner that is not based in the UK, and then you also have an all-Korean roster, which, you know, it's not an unsmart move, but I think it definitely raised people's concerns in terms of how you build that local momentum. But then when you have Code Red, and, you know, I've been following their work for a while, like, not only what they do in the UK, but they do a lot of interesting work in South Africa too, which is where I'm originally from, so yeah. I can't follow that. And that's the thing with what ultimately defines a lot of the Overwatch investments. It's not about how much money went in, it's really about the names they got involved. And in this case, you had a lot of people who've made built huge dynasties in the sports industry. And they know how to they know not only how to leverage esports, not to make it into a sport, but to take those elements that work for that type of competition, and also to utilize what unique opportunities the digital medium has, you know, to hopefully counteract this negativity that supposedly exists from the Esports Observer. I'm writing an article that should be out in a few days, so this will be kind of my preview of it, where I'm looking particularly at the merchandising aspect of the league and why I think, at least because in year one, I don't think that, you know, we're not going to see huge, you know, return on investment. I don't think we're going to see massive viewership, though who knows. But I do think the merchandising will be really a big change, short-term change that's going to happen in year one, because you look at only two aspects. You have the physical aspect, all right? First of all, this will be the first league that develops its own centralized team jerseys, right? Where every player has a jersey that looks basically the same as the guy playing on the opposite team. It's just it's a different color with different logos. But it's still, they still all say Overwatch League and Overwatch Season. That's not been done before. This was also a big thing because Blizzard will be producing the jerseys and selling them. And this is obviously part of the shared revenue model, but it's just, it's quite important because you can also do other things with it. So, for example, they have the numbers, they have the team names, and whilst, you know, for example, football shirt sales, you know, people like say like, oh, yeah, you can pay back Ronaldo's transfer fee with shirt sales. No, you can't, but it's still a very important revenue stream for every team. And they can do this by building personalities within the Overwatch League, having customizable shirt numbers and names, and selling the individual shirt numbers and names for players.
Yeah.
And you can, even if it doesn't make, you know, a huge amount of money, you can start to gauge, or it's all about gauging audience reaction and fan engagement with that. You can see what shirts are selling.
Yeah, we've seen how just very simple changes with the T-Mobile sponsorships of TSM and Cloud9, like how well just those little bits of variety were received by the fans just because they were limited edition. Also, if you look back to kind of earlier this summer, when Optic's Call of Duty team won the World Championships, their merchandising sales for a few months after that were, I think, well over 100k per month, which for merchandising for like a small esports, like a relatively small esports organization, or just a small company, not a small esports organization, was pretty massive.
Yeah, it's quite a lucrative thing for any team, and that's why I think until now most of the endemic teams have been reluctant to kind of, I don't know if this is something that, you know, the other big tournament organizers have ever proposed to them, but I would assume they've all been reluctant to do it because they don't want to give up any of those revenues, even though, particularly in the case of Blizzard, they could have they could bring the team brand to a much wider market than was previously possible.
Yeah, and as long as the teams are able to activate sponsors on their own, then that's going to be be healthy. Another great example that I always use, because I love mixed martial arts as well as esports. Mm-hmm. I always try and find some parallel between the two, just because they are two of this generation's most watched sports. Everything else seems to be petering off with our age group. But the UFC actually did a really interesting and quite controversial merchandising partnership, which I think should be heeded as a warning. Before this partnership, each individual fighter would be able to reach out for sponsorships on their own basis, and even relatively unknown fighters would be able to get quite a big paycheck. Now, in a prize sport where in the UFC they don't pay a huge amount to turn up and to win, you know, and the massive bonus is to actually win your fight, these sponsorships were more than enough to pay for people's camps to go and train internationally, to get medical fees they might have. Then a few years back, the UFC did an exclusive partnership with Reebok, and they produced a uniform that all fighters would have to wear. That took away any opportunity for them to be wearing any sponsored non-Reebok clothing or branding in and around the event, which is absolutely massive. The payment plan was pretty poor. You'd have kind of 10 fight veterans only getting paid kind of 20 grand if they won to fight, when they were probably used to taking home about 140, maybe 120, which is a massive change. Now, that's not going to be replicated in esports, I think. It's just a example that I think is worth bearing in mind if you look at where all the power already lies with the IP owners, and whether, if merchandising becomes a key and leading revenue stream around franchised esports, that situation doesn't become replicated.
Yeah, because you already have the problem that the games and the competitions and so on are licensed to the publisher. Exactly. Now you have the issue where the competition clothing is as well, and that has, you know, good and bad ramifications. I mean, the one thing, you brought up the idea of like having an individual sponsor. I mean, I guess, you know, esports players aren't to that point where even the best esports player will struggle to find like unique sponsors for themselves. There's some one or two examples. But I think as well, it does offer some huge opportunity. And the biggest one, of course, is the in-game virtual team uniforms, which is not an entirely new concept. I mean, Riot has done the same thing since 2015 for the League of Legends World Championship, where the winners get their own set of skins for players to use afterwards. But there's, you know, the way that Overwatch are approaching it is the skins will be available at the beginning of the season. Every team will have one. That means, you know, we're talking like, what, 12 teams, 36 playable characters, I think. So that's about 300 and something collectible skins, which is, you know, quite incredible. And obviously right now they're going to have to be very careful how they play this, because we're in the middle of a very heavy controversy with loot boxes and microtransactions. And if they push it too far with, like, let's say they did like a legendary skin for the championship team, I mean, maybe that's probably, I would deem that as acceptable, but there's definitely, if they push the envelope too far, then people will complain. This is going to be a new level of sports merchandising, and the problem is where you have to find that line between, because gamers have always had such a heavy, intolerance to this kind of cash grab, as we've seen with Battlefront 2, Star Wars Battlefront 2. You know, they will have to be careful with this. But if they play it right, it will benefit all the franchises involved with the league. I think as a player, as an Overwatch player myself, I'm quite interested to get hold of a few of these skins. Yeah, I think it's for me, that's the most exciting aspect of the league, and I don't really think it's getting enough attention, actually. Maybe that shows, like, that I'm an esports business journalist. Everyone's talking about, like, oh, isn't it great? Like, you know, a massive league with teams all over the world, and I'm just here like, yeah, the merchandising opportunities are so great.
Well, maybe it's just because you're getting bombarded with all of the other high-level stuff that, you know, it makes you kind of see what's missing. If you're not in control of the narrative, but if you're packaging out all of the information that you're getting in it, yeah. I guess it would make you pick up on the little bits. Let's take a step backwards for 1 second and go back to our chat around investment. You guys at The Observer have obviously had some really interesting news over the course of the last month and a half, maybe? I've been trying to get a hold of Chris since Leaders, really, because we've been trying to work on a few things. And yeah, it's really exciting. Obviously, you guys have been invested in by the Sports Business Journal, which is insane.
To lay out clearly, so it's from ACBJ Publishings, and of course they own Sports Business Journal and Sports Business Daily, which, if people don't know, are, I would say, the biggest sports business publications in the US. Which, you know, I could stop there. That's already that's insane. And of course we're you know, as part of this, you know, this investment is a strategic partnership, and you can kind of see how it's not just a case of a funding round. You know, this is very much like a small integration, and it's for the past month and a half. You know, we've taken changes in very incremental steps. So if you go on our website homepage now, you'll see that we have the SBJ SBD logo next to our own. Sure. We've been working with Ben Fisher. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I recognize the name, but I don't think I've worked with
him. So Ben Fisher is one of their staff writers, and he's been their like go-to esports guy. He also writes for the Olympics. I mean, really gifted journalist, you know, incredible knowledge base. He's been having, I'm sure, a great time with what's happening with Pyeongchang and the Winter Olympics. So basically, he's been kind of their esports guy. But I guess what they wanted out of Tio is they want someone who is, you know, a website that's very much dedicated to the market, that can expend a lot of space into it. I mean, right now, that you know, for me, I posted this on all my social media things when it first went live, is that we're now integrated somewhat into their homepage. You know, if you go to the Sports Business Daily homepage and you scroll down, they have all the different news feeds, and there has a special one for esports, which is powered by the Esports Observer. And for me, like, oh, it was such an amazing feeling. That's essentially it. And I think it's a really, for me, it's a nice scene as well, because it reminds me a lot of, you know, when ESPN decided to open their own esports section and start really like branch that out, because it just shows that the, you know, one thing I've always been nice to see is that the traditional sports media, the traditional sports family, you can see that by all the team owners, there's never been any kind of pushback towards esports. There's always, you know, been very, I feel, progressive, very forward thinking. They see the potential that, I mean, all you need to do is just go to one esports event and you're already like, that's how you convert people. And so they see the huge potential in it. They see that, you know, there's such a high level competition. They see that the fan engagement is out of this world. And what they need is I think people who just, you know, It's not enough to say understand the market, right? Because I think it goes much further than that to really have like an eye on where the market's developing. Because esports is full of all these weird little sub markets and sub developments, and you know, even you know, the average person who's just come into it won't know even how certain leagues develop or how prize money is distributed, for example. There's a lot of minutiae knowledge, and we're kind of working around the clock to work on ways that we can start to digest that to their readership, and also, you know, help. How we can reach that to their readership.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting aspect of the media scene in esports to see ESPN do so well, to see Yahoo Esports crumble when their parent company was acquired, and also seeing you guys make this partnership work with SBJ and the guys behind them. Here's a kind of question, which you might not feel comfortable answering, but I'm going to ask you anyway. With the increasing professionalization of the esports market globally, that obviously includes media and news. Do you think that there will still be a space for esports-specific business sites such as Dot Esports, such as Score Esports, without these kind of partnerships as the likes of ESPN and the SBJ with the Esports Observer continue to take strides forward and start producing some content that is really head and shoulders above the rest, or what we've been used to for the last few years?
I mean, I actually asked a similar question when I went to that first Esports Observer Network event during the Q&A session, because I said, you know, I've written for one or two, you know, endemic esports news sites, and I also, my kind of personal hobby horse has seen how the mainstream media covers it. I mean, I have a bit of a UK bias, obviously, so I see how what stories the BBC covers.
Oh, God, don't get me started.
It's going to get a little better. I saw one that was so cute during Worlds, as they, BBC Wales did a report on the first Welsh player to make it to Worlds. And I really should have reached out to that writer. I wanted to know how did that happen? Like, because obviously there's someone there who's a fan of esports and wanted to bring it there. But, I mean, yeah, that's always the problem.
It's more of a sad state of affairs for how poor the UK talent scene is, that we're making big noise about one Welsh player getting through, or the fact that we had like a few English players in COD or League of Legends, you know.
It's a whole another can of worms to open, I know.
Yeah, some of the things we were speaking about with Red Eye as well today was how can we fix this? I mean, out of 60 million people in the country, almost 3 million of those are esports fans.
Yeah.
Some of the strongest viewing data from any market, and we're only represented with very posh or regional accents on a production desk.
We're the number one exporter of casters.
Anyone else ever forget it? Yeah.
But to kind of answer your question, so I've seen reports, but I mean, even in America, obviously, Forbes will have written some pretty good content, and who else? You know, Wall Street Journal did the odd one, Bloomberg did the odd one. So all these sites kind of take like a kind of zoo animal approach to the way they cover esports. Like, oh, look at it, get your cameras out. Isn't it fascinating? But none of them have, you know, Daily Mail has
it. That's a really good way of putting it.
The Daily Mail is the only one I know that has a dedicated section so far. And even then, that's pretty much just, you know, pure coverage, because whilst I'm not a fan of the Daily Mail, their sports coverage has always been pretty good. So it's at least nice to see them. But that is something you are eventually going to see is, you know, I say eventually, but eventually the mainstream media will start covering esports. They will start like covering the games. They'll build match tickers on their site. They'll give, you know, produce odds maybe if that's what they do, if they already do that for sports. And that does raise the question, well, what happens to all the sites that have been covering this for years, that have all the established writers? Will all those writers be poached, you know, because they don't want to build it with people who don't really know quite how to talk about it? I mean, maybe it gets to the point where nearly everyone knows. That talent pool gets much wider, so maybe it's a lot easier. But, absolutely. And I think this is maybe – I don't want to speak, you know, to the plans of these future companies, especially, you know, the other esports, right, you know, publications, but certainly like some other media groups might look to acquire, they might look to invest and build up. I mean, this was the question I asked at that network event, and I don't feel like I got an answer then, and I don't really have an answer now, is, you know, what would be the best way forward, whether you just leave these sites as is, you know, you help, you fund them, you help develop them, or you build your own ones. I have no idea, because it's interesting to know how Reddit attitudes will change in that time.
Or we just rely on the power of Reddit and just meme our way through the next few years. That'll be fine.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I mean,
how did you not think of this viable alternative? awesome. So really, really keen to see what you guys can do over the next, I would say the next few years, but, you know, things and strategies in esports seem to change every 6 to 12 months. So I'm really excited to see what you guys can be doing next year. I know there's a really close partnership with Laggard there on the Esports Rising stuff as well. So I am keen to see how those roll out in Europe and also internationally. So that's going to be dope. We are running slightly against the clock. We've still got a fair bit of time, and I wanted to leave some time for us to talk about something which is exceptionally meta, seeing as you run a podcast, I'm hosting a podcast, and we're actually talking on a podcast, and that is podcasting in esports. I feel like through the ages, there have been some really interesting shows that have kind of followed the podcasting format. If you go back to the executives in the early, I think 2010, maybe 2003, maybe 2005, that's a pretty big window, but it had the likes of Odie from Dignitas. It had Craig Levine, who's now the CEO of ESL NA, and they were just talking through the business of esports. I think that this kind of medium for really starting to build a tangible connection with the audience, put your insight out there, and really start to inform people, or just to kind of elevate the business knowledge of the space, it's a really awesome way forward. It's starting to see, I mean, Optic have been doing a podcast for ages. There are quite a few other teams that have been doing one as well. The Score Esports has been doing quite well.
I'm a pretty big fan of the Score one. I really like that one, actually.
I do. I would love to see a lot more kind of businesses and teams start to pick up podcasting as a way to actually give some more context behind their message. You know, there's only so much you can put into a press release. Video content typically really well produced and is like super, super focused. I'm not saying that podcasts aren't, but the kind of free-forming conversation is a much slower but a lot more important and tangible way of actually getting to know someone who you know.
Just to sort of look at how I approach this from my podcast is I approached it with this stance of like, I don't want necessarily to be the guest to be the point of listening to the show. You know, I always like to try and get people who are, you know, regularly seen at conferences and are very highly sought out speakers. And I'm hoping as time progresses, I do, you know, start to get some of those like high level people maybe that appear on Score 2. But my thing is always like, I want the topic of the episode to sell itself. And that means I need people with a good amount of knowledge, and some of them I've met myself in person, some of them I knew literally as we began the show. But the point is that I want you to, for my show, I like people to come away, you know, having really learned something about the industry. And we've gone through a wide range of topics. So, you know, we did one looking at player behavior, you know, in the game and outside the game. We've done, you know, sport. One of my favorites, sorry, Joe, but my favorites are still the sports psychology episode with Weldon Green and Kane from Fnatic. I just really liked hearing those two kind of shit because that kind of meta level stuff is really great. We've done ones on like the integrity scene with Ian Smith and Anna Bauman. And, we've done very like, you know, the most recent one was on data and esports, which is a topic that like, I'm surprised we fit it as much as we did in one episode because that's going to spawn off into so many episodes, I can tell. But the idea is just to kind of break down like the mechanisms of the industry to first of all find things that aren't really talked about enough, and then because I think the average esports like listener, and of course we are going for a B2B audience, I'm aware of that, but if an average listener came in and they're an esports fan, they already know how the games and tournaments and teams operate to an extent. But they probably might not know, a lot about how talent recruitment works, or they might not know how a company approaches, you know, building a stadium or that kind of thing. And so that's kind of where I want to focus a bit more on. And as time progresses, I also do want to not turn it into a debate, but definitely the big problem I find with a lot of esports conferences in the wild is there's just not enough critical discussion. You know, like always respectful it needs to be. Star Wars Last Jedi influence coming over me, but at the same time I feel like having a conversations where people can actually say, like, you know what, I disagree entirely with what you just said. That's the phrase I'm waiting to hear on my show. And my dream, actually, and maybe we'll end up doing it if this is a TO event next year, I can't promise, is I'd love to have just an on-stage debate. You know, when the Overwatch League was really starting to kick off and everyone was arguing a bit, we were having arguments in the office, we were like, we should organize a debate. We should get one person who really thinks this isn't going to work and one person who really thinks it will and just see them go at it on stage. And, you know, that never came to fruition, but it's still, but there'll be plenty of chances like that in the as new crazy esports leagues and tournaments start to come up, or any new weird business venture. And you know, as long as people can do it without getting physical, I think I would love. That's what I would love to see more. And I think podcasts are a good medium to do that, because arguments do tend to attract listenership, but at the same time, like it's fascinating to be behind and in front of the microphone for those kind of discussions.
Yeah, it's easier to kind of really explore through a topic of conversation and kind of actually explain your reasoning in a longer form rather than just being reactionary. Like, if it's kind of a passive space where you already know you're going to be speaking about a topic or something like that, then it's a safer space for you to maybe feel like more of yourself. One of the things I feel like for conferencing debates, when you want people on other sides of an issue, one of the obstacles to that, I would absolutely love to see that, and I would love to attend or put on events myself that actually had that sort of thing. But the one thing that is an issue with that kind of structure is that if people are really honest with themselves, then they know that there is quite a strong negative or positive trade-off that could actually come out of those debates if they get made to look like a fool.
Yep.
So I could see why some people would rather go for something more passive. At the same time, you kind of hope that charismatic business leaders that really know their product would be very confident in their point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I have to be kind of like, I had that kind of, you know, passionate vision, but at the same time, I have to be realistic, because the you know, these kind of debates and arguments are something you see more in kind of university spaces, and or at least you used to. But with business, you know, with business owners, and I've kind of learned this more being, you know, a business journalist in a way I really wasn't ever before, was, you know, people are obviously very selective about what they say. Everything has to go through their PR department. And, so it's obviously bring someone on when they want to, like, I mean, obviously I would hope if you agree to a debate, you know, the impact this will have on you. Sure. as a stakeholder. But I understand, like, you know, there's probably a reason why these kind of discussions don't happen in, at least not to my knowledge, in other industries and at conferences in other industries.
Yeah, I think everyone likes to keep the peace and be relatively political. It's very different if you're going to be, like everyone does in a business context, which is when you normally, you might potentially share your true thoughts over an alcoholic beverage or later in the evening rather than in a public forum. I am really, really keen to see how the events on your side start to play out. And yeah, I think that the more content that is out there that kind of focuses on this area of the market, like the Esports Roundtable and the TO podcast, then the overall scene is just going to be elevated. One last thing I'll say before we go on to our final recurring segment of the week is one thing that stuck with me from my lunch with Red Eye earlier today was when we were talking about putting this kind of content out, there is a worthy concern about removing the magic from the fan perspective. Some mystery, some kind of fourth wall that is broken in terms of them understanding a little bit too much about the space might kind of drop some of the unique sheen from the space, you know.
Can you give me an example? I kind of think I know what you're driving at, but maybe just get an example.
So perhaps, I don't know, if we take looking at players specifically, if the package data is a lot more available these days, but perhaps if you kind of show the ins and outs of how a deal or a sponsorship or a partnership or an investment is put together in quite tenuous detail, perhaps that might kind of take away some of the hype, you know.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that I think for those that are making content in this realm is worth being relatively responsible about. Graham, we have hit the end for our much shorter version of the show.
Sure.
So I've got one more question to ask you before I let you move on.
Sure.
For this week, we are going to be taking a quantum break with Graham Ashton.
Mm-hmm.
We have a really cheesy title that we change every week. We've gone so far down the rabbit hole of anything relating to time that I start to feel a little bit sick every time I say it. So we might have to change it. But Graham,
yes.
The question stands regardless. If you could have any pro-facing role in any esports title, past, present, fantasy, or future, what would it be and why?
So if I'm understanding correctly, if I could choose to be any kind of competitor or coach or manager for any game in any league.
Manager, yep. Analyst, water boy.
Yep. We don't have those.
Someone to start.
My answer is I would be
dabbing
the first.
Sweat off the forehead. The first water boy. It's not a bad answer.
It's so funny because that's the point I didn't get to with the Overwatch merchandising thing. Is that that's the one thing I feel like is it's great that they're taking control of the shirts, but I mean I've looked at what they're selling and it's still the same kind of like micro polyester stuff. I'm like, this stuff is not made for like 3 hours of sweaty on stage gaming. I'm sorry.
No, it's disgusting.
People trying to change that too. But my answer would actually be, it's probably a strange one at first, but I can explain it, is I would love to have been like a Hearthstone player at the Hearthstone World Championships. And that's quite weird to think now because Hearthstone esports is not at its peak. In fact, it hasn't been for a long time. But it's how I really started getting interested in esports in a big way. Because I'm not even sure how. It's just I happened to play the game. I started watching it, and then that's where I kind of got tuned into the larger esports its world. You know, there's people who've been around since StarCraft up came was a big thing and Counter Strike as well. But for me, you know, I look at the kind of thought process that's involved in being a Hearthstone pro, and maybe it's just because I'm terrible at math. But, I love that kind of analytical calculating thing where you can work out – because, I mean, people say like, Hearthstone's all RNG. But at the same time, that means, you know, the players have to have incredible probability calculation skills and, the ability to think 5 moves ahead. And, maybe it's just because I put so much time and effort into being – trying to be a good Hearthstone player and never really getting anywhere with it, that I really envy the ability of the pro Hearthstone players, especially because, you know, for all that talk about the games based on randomness, there's such consistency in the pro scene. And, you know, many of them are actually former poker players. I just felt like whilst that scene has continued, whilst I think it's like, I wish Blizzard would, just kind of give it more gravitas. I mean, I know they have invested quite a lot into it, and they've changed the tournament structure so many times, and the commentators are some of the best talent in esports. I just still feel like those players have such a high skill cap. And, of course, you know, I still think it's – unless, you know, because StarCraft is going to hit, I can't think of another solo esport that is as popular. And that's a big thing because, you know, it's one thing to see a team work together and the stories you create around that, but to see a single player, like, go through that long journey because, you know, getting to the Hearthstone World Championships is such a slog. It has a very different competitive structure to any other esports. I envy those guys to no end, and I would love to be in their shoes.
I played Hearthstone very, very briefly, and I think I'm just going to leave it to that. The annals of history, and let everyone else who's still very passionate, like yourself, keep the flame burning on the Hearthstone sunset. Graham, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you very much for having me on the Esports Observer podcast. Where can everyone reach you if they want to get in touch, if they want to maybe submit some work, or if they want to tweet you some insight, or if they want to tell you all of the secrets?
Yeah, can they reach you? Those are all things we would love to hear, especially the secrets. So our website is esportsobserver.com, and you can find us under the same name on Facebook and Instagram. We also have our Twitter is a bit different. It's esportsobserved, past tense, and that's not quite right. But and then you can also find me on Twitter at Graham_Ashton. The podcast itself is just the Esports Observer podcast, and it's on SoundCloud, it's on iTunes. I would also say, one thing we've done, and we're hoping to build up more video content, but definitely, like, if you like getting esports news in very little, like, bite-sized chunks, we do a weekly roundup video where I'm on camera, and I basically just tell you everything, big headline that happened in esports that last week. That's where you can find us, and you can enjoy all our offerings through esportsobserver.com.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you very much for tuning in. If you want to tell me about the episode if you want to give us any feedback. Then I am at Barely Qualified on Twitter. It'll be down in the description. I'm not going to spell it for you like last week. And if you want to reach out to us on Facebook, we are LFG Esports HR. We are going to be putting some surveys together to get your insight on what you would like from the Esports Roundtable moving to live format. So stay tuned for those, and we'll be pumping those out across all channels. Graham, thank you very much for your time. Everyone else, we will speak to you soon.